I feel completely liberated. I'm giving a talk without a mask on. I have a cup of tea. I can't tell you, it really feels nice to get on the other side of that. So I knew I had to give a talk on the first day of term, and I was having trouble deciding what to talk about, and I pulled out all my notes. And I was like, well, should I talk about trauma, trauma-informed care and how it functions here, coping with crisis? Despair is always a good topic, right? knuckling down and bearing down into your vow for the term. And then I just thought, forget it. I want to talk about having fun. I want to talk about being happy. I want to talk about just enjoying our lives a little bit. But I'll get there through Dharma. So we have this word sanshin, which means three minds. In Zen, they're considered a part of the essential package for mature practice, is to cultivate these three minds. Daishin, magnanimous mind or great mind, is that calm and steady acceptance and equanimity. All-inclusive view, non-differentiation. Dogen called it the mind that is unprejudiced and refuses to take sides. I like that. The second one is Roshin, nurturing mind. We often call it grandmotherly mind. The characters actually mean old woman heart. It's the pleasure of helping others to mature. It's accepting others unconditionally, while at the same time encouraging their growth. Dogen says this is caring for other people and things as if they are our own eyes. And third is Kishin, joyful mind. And it's specifically the joy of finding delight in chaos, in difficulty, in the ability to enjoy the complex richness of the samsara world. Being grateful for what you have. And it's not a conditional mind. It's the ability to be undisturbed. So notice that connection. The joyful mind is undisturbed. And undisturbedness gives us the joyful mind. But notice that all these states of mind include joy. They include contentment in the world as it is. And I sense when I read these descriptions how relaxed this happiness is. It's not in a hurry. It's not full of effort. It's not striving. It's just about being there. It's just relaxed. It's the joy that rises as the natural aspect of interconnectedness. Very simple contentment. No hurry, no pressure. So when was the last time you goofed off? I mean, it's the end of summer, right? So I hope it wasn't too long ago. But seriously, goofed off. Now, if you... What?
Can you do that, seriously?
Yes, well, we're going to talk about that. I'm here to encourage you to goof off. There's the dictionary definitions are so negative. They're all about shirking work. That's one of the definitions of goofing off. Shirking work or evading responsibility or wasting time. That's how it's defined. Goofing off satisfies no should. And we have a lot of shoulds. There's no justification. That's I think, the real key definition of goofing off is activity with no justification. And it's harder than it looks. It's really tricky. We all feel the pressure to be doing something, anything. It's an American quality, and it's definitely a Zen quality. There's always something that needs to be done. Around here, there's just always things to be done, right? I'm looking at you, Zonio. There's just so many things to do. We are not skilled at goallessness. So doing your cardio workout does not count as goofing off, right? When you really goof off, it's going to provoke a reaction in other people. It might be a little envy. It might be a little censure. because we're not trained how to do this. We're conditioned against shirking from an early age, and that conditioning doesn't stop even when we're trying to relax. I found this book on stress and relaxation that had this amazing quote: choose to practice relaxation. Make these relaxation tools work for you. Regular, consistent practice is essential if you want to gain maximum benefit from these skills. That's how to relax. Oy vey, right? So dancing in the park, that's good. That's goofing off, right? But walking 10,000 steps a day is not goofing off. It's good for you. There's nothing wrong with walking 10,000 steps a day. But worrying all the time about doing what's good for us is not goofing off. Can you wholeheartedly just play? We can wholeheartedly work. Can we wholeheartedly play? I have a lot of resistance to goofing off. I'm always doing too much. I was raised by hard workers who didn't suffer fools very gladly and didn't waste time. And then I started practicing Zen Buddhism in my early 20s, right? It was like, it's like the perfect non-Christian Puritanism is to come out of my family and become a Zen Buddhist. So to outsiders and new practitioners, go figure, we wear black, we look at walls, we talk about death. It seems like it could be kind of a serious practice. And it was to me, and I was very serious about it. It took me a while to notice, to really understand how much wit and how much play there is in Zen. Wow. Under the skin of the teaching and the Dharma, I began to hear sarcasm and irony and eventually profanity and an irreverence that is historically very significant in Zen. Zen is anarchic and irreverent. And I was really thrilled when I first saw senior practitioners goofing off. When I saw Kyogen use a slip and slide, I was so excited. I was so happy. Once he was whacking away at the pinata on Vaisak and he fell down and his robes went up and his underwear was showing and the kids were laughing, and I was like thrilled, right? Playing softball. Without a little explanation, Zen can seem to be a preoccupation with suffering, right? A withdrawal from the lightness of life. And that's not true at all, even though it's based on a kind of truth. Like a lot of stereotypes, it's based on a kind of truth. We are making a deep, concerted effort to step out of the patterns that cause us suffering, and we're aiming for an emotional equilibrium. And it takes a while to figure out what that looks like. Real equilibrium is not emotionlessness. It's non-reactivity, which is very different. Eventually, emotional reactions become natural and spontaneous and appropriate rather than conditioned and based on old scripts. And that is a kind of undisturbedness when you just react naturally and appropriately to the circumstances without being pushed by outside forces. But it takes us a long time. For years, people work at suppressing their emotions or denying their emotions or escaping from their feelings, trying to figure out how to control it. There's also a kind of hair shirt Zen. This no pain, no gain philosophy, more pain means more gain, right? A really ascetic for the sake of asceticism kind of practice. So, walking through a field of wildflowers is a pretty goofy thing to do, right? There's no point to that. Gardening is not goofing off. But it's good to enjoy flowers that bloom all by themselves. It's good to remember there's another side to this. We are engaged in this very serious work of awakening. And I want to say sometimes in our lives we feel entirely serious. We feel a kind of deep solemnity or profundity. We feel the gravity of life. Solemn means sacred, awesome, or formal. And there are serious times when that's how we feel. We feel deeply formal and sacred. But these times of solemnity are not in opposition to times of lightheartedness. All times are passing moments. We pick them up, we put them down as they come. So it is one thing to be serious. We all have to be serious at times. And it's another thing to take things seriously all the time. There is a time for taking things seriously, but it's a time. It's not forever. And I really caution about taking practice too seriously. Because if you make practice sacred in that solemn way, then you will be more easily offended, not less. You will be more reactive, not less. There will be more taboos, not fewer. You'll have a sacred cow all of a sudden that you have to protect. And we do this to ourselves too. Don't take yourself too seriously. I did for so long. I was so sensitive to anything that felt like teasing. And I can still react to what feels like teasing because I'm taking myself too seriously. I'm making myself into a kind of sacred cow, right? So one of the values of goofing off, of being silly, of doing something that doesn't have any justification, is to notice where it makes you constrict. If you just went home today and did nothing important or necessary, what in you gets tight? What in you starts to talk back? What is that voice saying about what you should be doing? Goofing off will show you exactly how you feel about what is important and serious, where the taboos are. One reason this topic is important to me is that the first few years of my practice were heavily influenced by formal monastic settings. We went to the abbey for sesshin, very strict monastic environment. They were long, they were difficult retreats. And I was afraid that this beloved religion I'd thrown myself into, that it was a dour place. And we didn't see those monks running on a slip and slide, believe me. They were always, you know, in their formal state when we met them. So that was my introduction to Zen, was this formality. But the core is really anarchism. We transform through our willingness to question conventions. The conventions of our culture, the conventions that we were raised with, but also the conventions we've put on ourselves. We have to learn to question everything. To call everything into question. Ourself, what we believe about ourself, all of our plans and expectations have to be up for investigation. Nothing escapes. And Zen definitely will ridicule your serious self. Your serious attachment to a non-existent self is at the root of a lot of koans. Oh, speaking of koan, I'll get to that. The most profound joy, the deepest laughter, comes from really wholly examining your relationship in the world, because there you find this interconnectedness. You find this place of where nothing can be disturbed. It's partly about the ability to drop goals, to just be. If you've done Vajrayana practice, you've probably encountered what they call slogans, which are practice guidelines. And one of them is always maintain only a joyful mind. That kind of sounds like a rule, doesn't it? You have to be joyful. But this is how Trungpa Rinpoche explains it. He says, we have a lot to be cheerful about. You are on the path. You are actually doing something about yourself, which is fantastic. You should be tremendously excited. And he goes on for a while that when you get depressed, you should remember you are doing something about yourself, you're trying to change your life, and that that is the beginning of real compassion and so on. And then he says, you begin to take a very cheerful attitude toward the whole thing. So you are transcending oy vey, getting out of Brooklyn, metaphorically speaking. This kind of cheerfulness has a lot of guts. I really like that. It does have a lot of guts to be able to find that stable place, that steady place, and move freely to be liberated from being stuck in one state of mind, but to move freely and appropriately into what the world, what the moment requires. And Trungpa really emphasizes this is internally generated cheer. He uses the word cheer, not joy. It comes from our deep inner nature. And therefore, it's something we can turn to when there's nothing like it in the environment. When the world feels like it's on fire and everything is very serious in the world, we can still find that little fire of cheerfulness inside us. So this inner joy, that's why it's undisturbed. It's a deep equanimity. It's not too quiet. It's not too excited. It comes from dropping our constant self-protection. We protect ourselves against physical threats. We protect ourselves against emotional threats. We protect ourselves against all kinds of ways that we think we might be injured. And if we can drop that, then this joy that comes from the Tathagata Garbha, its original self, is in love with the world. And it just comes up. So, let's see. If you have ice cream, I will give you some. If you don't have ice cream, I will take it away. That's your ice cream koan. Come on. The eminent theologian Alfred North Whitehead, has anybody read Whitehead? Wonderful, wonderful writer. He said, I have always noticed that deeply and truly religious persons are fond of a joke, and I am suspicious of those who aren't. So what do we really expect if we are looking for an accomplished person, a mature person in the practice? What are we looking for? Is it somebody who is tight and ascetic? Is it somebody who doesn't smile? Or is it somebody who is at home with themselves? I'm looking for a person who feels graceful and kind of relaxed in different circumstances. And I don't really trust a senior practitioner who never falls down, who is always careful and doesn't make mistakes. I want to see what happens when a person falls down. I've learned a lot from my reactions to falling down. And watching my teacher fall down and my seniors fall down, how they got up was really important. So that's part of it, is this sort of lightness of being, this graceful lightness of being, and curiosity, and a simple enjoyment, the ability to just enjoy. All right, so a couple of jokes, then I'll stop. Most of you know I can't resist a cheap joke, and I had this in common with Kyogen, and we were not always appropriate. And I'm still not always appropriate with it. I feel guilty sometimes. But what is a Zen vacuum cleaner like? Anybody know? It has no attachments. So, of course, I had to find out how many Buddhists it takes to screw in a light bulb. There are a lot of answers, which is part of the joke. I think it's really funny. That's so funny that there's a lot of answers. I found a Tibetan site that had 7 different answers, one for each sect. So it was like, how many Nyingmas does it take to screw in a light bulb? How many Galuptas does it take to screw in a light bulb? And I didn't understand any of the answers, which is also pretty funny. But this is one of my favorite jokes lately. So, Three forest-dwelling monks are meditating on the banks of a river. And the first one suddenly jumps up and says, "Oh, I forgot my mat." And he steps off the riverbank and walks across the surface of the water, gets his mat, and returns. And after a while, the second monk says, "Oh, I forgot to put my underwear out to dry." And he steps off the bank and walks lightly across the surface of the water, hangs out his underwear, and returns. Now, the third monk is pretty upset at this point because he thinks he's being tested. So he jumps up and says, "I can match you," steps off the riverbank and falls in. He climbs out, he steps off again and sinks. And this keeps happening until the first monk turns to the second one and says, "Do you think we should tell him where the rocks are?" Okay. I'll tell you a few of the answers for how many Buddhists does it take to change a light bulb. You all know the first one, I'm sure. None, because light bulbs change all by themselves. Another answer is all is illusion. There are no light bulbs. Another, how many Buddhists does it take to change a light bulb? A tree in a golden forest. However many the shuso assigns. I like that. When I read that, I thought of how many retreats where I've seen like four people change a light bulb for half an hour because they were told they were assigned. How many Buddhists does it take to change a light bulb? The darkness is perfect. Anyway, that's my talk for today. Ice cream cone.
Thank you, Jiko. We will now have a period of questions, comments. If you're in the Zendo, raise your hand. I'll bring the mic to you. Please state your name. If you're on Zoom, go ahead and type your question or comment in the chat box, and it'll be read aloud, or your name, and you will be unmuted. And we have one in the Zendo.
Hi, Jiko. Thank you. I really related to the business, all the instructions about relaxing and you have to do this and you have to do that. There was a period of time in my life, well, I would say quite a bit of time in my life, where the only way I could do stuff was to make it a duty or an obligation or a responsibility. That was the only thing that made me, and so, you know, that's what I would have done. I would have said, oh, this is important for my mental health and whatever, so I have to do this. So I really get that. I taught the intro workshop yesterday for Zen meditation, and it was really fun, really enjoyed it. At least two people were asking this question about no goals, like no goals in the practice. And I had a few things to say, but it's not, you know, it's not so easy to explain what this, because certainly we have aspirations, certainly we're trying to like improve our lives or whatever that is. So how does that work with no goals? And I ended up quoting Kat Aguirre, who says your spiritual progress is not your business. Yeah, as soon as you try to take control of it, you're gonna mess it up, mm-hmm. basically. And a couple other things I said, but I was wondering if you would want to address that a little further.
Well, it's one reason I wanted to do this talk today is because we just made all our vows, right? We just Kyogen would say that the vow is the North Star. I really liked that image. That this morning we oriented ourselves to our North Star. But you can't if you walk facing the North Star, you're just promptly going to fall on your face. All you can do is watch the path in front of you and take one step at a time. Now and then you look up and reorient. Are you still going in the right direction? Is the path you're on taking you where you want to go? But mainly you're just walking. And I think that's one way to approach it. Sometimes the business of right now is to do the things that will get you toward something, but then you are done with that and you have to put it down and come back and check later. Is it getting you there? But I love that category line because it's like Suzuki saying that Zazen is good for nothing. Zazen doesn't care. It's just a space in which you can rise and fall.
Thank you.
Yeah.
I don't know if I remember. I don't remember if I told people that my name is Genko. But
Right. We're supposed to say our name at the start.
In case people wondered, that's right.
Because we used to not be able to see our faces.
This is Sage. You can't see my face.
I can see the purple, though.
Yes, the purple's new. Thank you for this talk that was on my favorite subject. I love goofiness. Goofiness has always come naturally for me. What I noticed hasn't come naturally in my life was like goofiness without holding back or without reservation. Growing up, I would use goofiness to like avoid things. Mm-hmm. That is a surprising thing that I see myself getting more confident about being goofy the more that I practice. And I just think that's kind of funny. Really important and relevant in my life because I am a trans woman, and every single day, just about people like to make a game of like trying to make me angry, sort of. And it's really easy to brush it off now, and it never used to be. I don't know why that's coming up so much. Listening to your talk, but. I keep thinking about like the customers who have come in and like make a little comment or something and like have a little smug face about like as they walk by like I ruined someone's day today and I'm just like not really like I don't know, I think goofiness is a really important tool for practice.
Yeah, if you were a class clown or if you were the entertainer in your family or whatever, that's not goofing off. That's self-protection. That's acting. That's a form of protecting the self. So real goofing off really is fearless. It's not protecting anything. I think it's like you're discovering, it's a source of considerable strength. To not have to protect yourself all the time, to not have to have those barriers. When your self is stronger, then you don't have to have all these things around it. So
it's really surprising how spontaneous it is, too.
Yeah, I'm glad for you.
Thank you.
All right, so I don't know where this is going to fit into your description, but I have felt for a long time that goofing off is good for me, and I don't feel like it's in opposition to working or being productive or something like that.
I've actually long admired your ability to do nothing, so...
I treasure that.
I'm serious. She can really do nothing, and I'm always like, nah, 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 nah. And she's not doing anything. It's great. There's one over here too, Satan. So.
So I realize that your talk has brought up for me this, I guess, experience that I have where I have this fairly playful, irreverent self, but I don't know how to blend that or have that be integrated with what feels like my determined, disciplined self. And so I wonder if you could say something about how we bring all that together in one being.
Well, it's already one being. You already have them there, right? You have multiple selves, many selves. I think what you're asking about, though, is how do we sort of gracefully shift and easily pick them up and put them down? I mean, it can happen in a second. You know, I'm sure many of you have heard us laughing as we play croquet on Saturday afternoons, which is a completely purposeless waste of time. But somebody will say something and suddenly it just changes and everybody turns seriously toward that question. And then we can shift and pick the mallets up again. And it's all people who have a lot of years of practice. It's just something that comes with time, this ability to turn toward the moment. So you're in this moment of seriousness, and suddenly you can put it down and sing happy birthday to somebody in the office and wear a funny hat and then take it off and be the department head again. And there's nothing gained or lost in the shift. And I think maybe what you're working with is, am I losing something of the serious self when I let the goofy self arise? Am I going to be able to go back to it? And you have nothing to worry about. The serious self is going to be there. Okay. He's getting his 10,000 steps.
My name is Nancy. Thank you for your talk, Jiko. Yesterday was a mix of that. For me, my block party in my neighborhood was yesterday. We start in the morning. We paint the intersection, the compass rose. People just kind of literally come out of the woodwork, and there were children there and reggae music, you know, and just that for 3 hours. And then it was time to go away, and then time to come back for the cookout, which I was not going to be at because I was going to be at this very somber, solemn, holy occasion for Sonia's installation as a monk, which I was not going to miss for a minute. And it was a beautiful thing, and it was well attended, and it was joyful, but everybody was like kind of quiet until the end. And then I go back in the darkness to this street party, and out of nowhere I saw these swarms of children I have never met, dogs everywhere. There's not enough light to see what you're trying to eat off the table, and it just was like, yes. You know, the kids were screaming and running all over the place, and there was a wet bar, you know, there was a whiskey bar, and there was this and that and the other thing, and it's like, okay. All right. So that's about as crazy as it gets anymore for me, is just to get plopped in something like that for a while. And in the past, I'd be up till 3 or 4 in the morning at those things, you know, but I wanted to come today and make my ongo vow. That was important. And I knew I had to, you know, it's like, okay. It reminded me of like when school starts. It's like, okay, end of summer vacation. Okay, now put on your clean new clothes and go to school. And that kind of vibe. But I just enjoyed everything you said. And I'm so glad that it wasn't, not that they aren't important, another talk about hanging tough.
Right.
Thank you.
Yep. We have time for maybe two more.
Hi, I'm Sasha. The talk made me remember fairly recently, like a few weeks ago, I had a moment of like pure joy that I had never really had before, at least they're really rare for me. And I was at some like party for my dad's work or something, and I was with my little sister, and she wanted to go on the swings, and I hadn't been on the swings in years, and I got on there, and once I started going, I just started laughing and like having the time of my life. I felt so good. And then when I finished, my little sister was like, I've never seen you that happy before. I was like, really? She's like, you look so happy. I've started noticing more of those little things coming into my life as I've been practicing more.
You've discovered a very simple way to relax. I have often wondered why some smart entrepreneur didn't make a playground big enough for adults. Big swings, a big slide, a big merry-go-round. Man, I would be there. Yeah. Okay. I think Jitsuso had his hand up. And
thank you. First of all, Jiko, you got that last joke wrong. It's the priests, the minister, and the rabbi are in a sailboat. It's the walking across the water.
Oh, really? I didn't know there was another version of it.
Yeah. I just wanted to say, and your point about kind of being spontaneous, perhaps, doing what's in the what's right for the moment. It's one of the things I love about this place. I showed up one morning recently, pulled in on my bike, and there's Kakumyo on the ground playing with Ananda, his dog. And I thought, I love this place. Where else do I get to see the abbot doing something like that? So thank you, Kakumyo, for that lesson.
Yeah.